wars without end.
Wars without end.
The Ukraine, Gaza, ISIS.
That's right. Okay, so 25 minutes,
Typically,
and then go into peer discussion. Without further ado, hand over to Steve.
Yeah, good evening, everybody. Okay, so it's really four parts, an introduction, there'll be a conclusion at the end. I'm going to talk about the Ukraine and the war that occurred there this year. Also, I'm going to look at the war between Israel and the Palestinians in Gaza as well. And I'm going to finish off with ISIS or IS. I mean, that is still ongoing, but as is the Arab-Israeli war as well. And I think the thing in Ukraine is not finished with. So as an introduction, I want to say, in 1991, you know, the Western capitalist class said that the collapse of the Soviet Union would be the end of all wars and the end of history and the beginning of peace on Earth. But the world situation is as dangerous now as it was then. If actually, it could be even more dangerous. During the Cold War, there was a struggle for world dominance of the world economy between two capitalist superpowers, the Western-style free market capitalism versus the state capitalism of Russia. Now, with capitalism, there's always conflicts of economic interest. The capitalist system of society is rooted in conflict, and war is one of the evil fruits of that conflict. It's a system which has a built-in conflict between states and the capitalist groups they represent in the pursuit of profit. Rosa Luxemburg wrote, "The accumulation of capital employs force as a permanent weapon. Wars are fought over sources of raw materials, rich mineral deposits, investment outlets, vital trade routes over land, sea, air, markets and exploitable populations." We in the Socialist Party said in 1914, and this holds true today, the capitalists have quarrelled over the question of the control of trade routes and the world's markets and are endeavouring to exploit the political ignorance and blind passions of the working class of their respective countries in order to induce said workers to take up arms in what is solely their master's quarrel. I mean, a rich mineral resource is oil, and has been the reason for many wars in the last 100 years. As long as capitalism exists, wars will continue without end. This year has been a boon year. I mean, the Ukraine, Gaza, and obviously the rise of Islamic State. We will see, as Rosa Luxemburg wrote, that war is methodical, organised, gigantic murder, and that the high stage of world industrial development in capitalistic production finds expression in the extraordinary technical development and destructiveness of the instruments of war. So, the Ukraine. The war in the Ukraine arose out of the Euromaidan protests in Kiev in November 2013. Ukraine was under pressure from Russia, and it ended up backing out of a free trade agreement with the European Union. Pro-European Ukrainians view EU membership as sort of synonymous with democracy, and Ukraine is also actively pursuing NATO membership. But essentially, the divisions in the Ukraine are a conflict between two groups of the capitalist class over the choice of the external orientation of the country, either towards Russia or towards Europe. A bit of background about the Ukraine. I mean, Ukraine was and is still known as the breadbasket of Europe. It's fertile farmlands of rich black soil, which grows wheat, barley, rye, and other grain and oil crops. In 2011, it was the third largest grain exporter. And a 2013 forecast by the US Department of Agriculture reported that Ukraine is set to become the second largest grain exporter in the world. Ukraine also has a well-developed manufacturing sector, particularly in aerospace and industrial equipment, nuclear power and hydroelectric generation, and advanced rocket systems industry. Plus, it still has the old industries from the Soviet period of coal mining and iron ore mining. For the Russian capitalist class, the Ukraine is what's known as the near abroad, and therefore within what they believe is their sphere of influence. In February this year, the Crimea was occupied by Russia. It had been originally given to the Ukrainian Constituent Socialist Republic in the mid-50s. But the Crimea, since the 1700s, has always been the base of the Russian Black Sea Fleet. But since Ukrainian independence in 1991, the base in the Crimea has been leased from the Ukraine, and the leasing agreement was due to expire in 2017. And unlikely to be renewed. This would have meant Russia not having a warm water port giving access to the Mediterranean and via the Suez Canal to the Indian Ocean. Also, the Russian company Gazprom is competing with Exxon and Shell for the rich oil and gas deposits off the Crimean coast. In April, Chevron signed a 50-year lease to develop Ukraine's shale gas reserves, obviously promoting Russian fears about losing its influence in the Ukraine and losing a major gas market. Interestingly enough, Chevron's agreement with the Ukraine was supported by the US as part of its national security strategy to help reduce Russia's hold on Europe and Kiev. In April this year, pro-Russian separatists in the eastern Ukrainian province of Donetsk declared themselves independent of Kiev as the People's Republic of Donetsk. This is the old heartland of Soviet industry with its concentration of coal and steel production. It's the Don coal basin, which is known as the Donbass. Russia essentially wants the Donbass as a protectorate so that the Ukraine could never join NATO or fully orientate its foreign policy westward towards Europe. The Donbass region accounts for approximately 16% of Ukraine's GDP and 27% of industrial production. Now, this war in the eastern Ukraine has accounted for 3,000 people killed so far. Last December, in the magazine Coal Age, it reported that a production surplus in 2013 had hurt the Ukrainian coal industry, which needs to reduce the level of production, and in addition has decided to temporarily close about 17% of all mines in the country. Ukraine is the fourth largest coal producer in Europe after Russia, Germany and Poland. The Ukrainian coal industry is believed to have 4% of world coal reserves, or 33.9 billion metric tons of proven reserves. This is enough to maintain the level of coal mining for 2012 in the country for almost 400 years. As always in the capitalist crisis regarding this overproduction, the working class are made to pay for the failures of the capitalist system. Ukrainian miners in the Independent Trade Union of Miners at the Kryvyi Rih iron ore mine in the Kryvbass, which is the iron ore basin in eastern Ukraine, are actually fighting to defend their working class interests against attacks by the capitalist class, who are seeking to make redundancies and 30 to 50% cut in their real wages. Also, the miners have had to establish self-defence militias to defend themselves against intimidation and attacks by lumpen elements, which are called tatushka, and these have been recruited by the Russian separatists. Essentially, these are gangs of thugs organised by the mine bosses to crush the organised workers before the region can be absorbed into the petro-oligarchy and anarchic capitalist state that is Russia. I mean, the Western capitalist nations have actually imposed sanctions on Russia. Oil companies such as Rosneft, Trasneft and Gazprom, their exploration projects in Siberia and the Arctic have been affected, whereby foreign companies like Exxon and Shell have been barred from providing any equipment, technology or assistance to deep water, offshore or shale projects. But interestingly enough, Russian gas is delivered to Europe by pipeline, which probably explains why Gazprom's main business is reported not to be on the sanctions list. I mean, Russia has huge energy reserves. Oil and natural gas represent approximately 68% of Russia's total exports. Also, the EU is Russia's third biggest trading partner, with a cross-border trade of $460 billion, and the EU gets one-third of its oil and gas from Russia, and 40% of that gas is pumped across the Ukraine. Germany's economy exports of Russia are worth approximately $75 billion a year. In The Guardian in September, Larry Elliott wrote, "A key aim of Berlin's foreign policy for the past quarter of a century has been to reintegrate what used to be the Soviet Union and its satellites into the market economy. Expanding capitalism to the east was seen as both good for German business and for German security. Resistance from German industry makes it unlikely Angela Merkel will agree immediately to Iran-style sanctions that would freeze Russia out of Western markets." And then the objective of the US and European capitalist class is energy diversification in the Ukraine, which means to reduce dependence on Russian oil and gas. And the US and the EU are actually using the military threat of a revived NATO against Russia as part of the Western capitalist attempt at influencing the external orientation of the Ukraine towards Europe. The Lithuanian president said recently, "It is a fact that Russia is at war, is in a war state against Ukraine. That means it is in a state of war against a country which would like to be closely integrated with the EU. Practically, Russia is in a state of war against Europe." I just wanted to point out that Russia went to war with Georgia in August 2008 when Georgia sought to join NATO. So that's what's been happening in the Ukraine. I'm trying a bit of an analysis about why and what's been going on. The Israeli-Palestine war in Gaza, which took place this summer, July to September, I mean, it's just another round in the fighting that began in 1948 when the State of Israel was established. But it has to be pointed out, Palestine have no chance whatsoever of militarily defeating Israel. I mean, the GDP figures speak for it. Israel's GDP, approximately $110 billion, whereas the GDP for the Palestinian territories is something like $4.2 billion. I mean, in that 50-day war in July to September, 2,199 Palestinians in Gaza were killed, 70% of them civilians, 10,895 wounded, and 65,000 people were left homeless. A third of hospitals were destroyed or damaged. The tunnels between Gaza and Egypt, which were bringing $700 million into Gaza's economy through goods or services, were destroyed by bombing. Israel destroyed 134 Gazan factories and bombed Gaza's main power station. Without power to run the treatment plants, untreated sewage was pumped directly into the Mediterranean Sea, contaminating fish and sickening fishermen. The Food and Agricultural Organization reported that damage to Gaza's agricultural sector had forced farmers and herders to abandon their lands and has paralyzed fishing activities, bringing local food production to a halt and severely affecting their livelihoods. I mean, the Gaza factory owner, Mohammed Al-Talbani, put it in a nutshell, really, "This is a war on our economy," he wrote. Just a bit of background on Gaza. I mean, the Gaza Strip was occupied by Israel from 1967 until 2005. But it's been under siege by Israel actually since then. This blockade means that the borders and airspace are actually controlled by Israel. So that's foodstuffs, building materials, fuel and medical supplies have to be brought in via these tunnels between Gaza and Egypt. Even livestock is transported through these tunnels. Olive trees, they're the lifeblood of Palestinian agriculture, and it's almost the only crop which grows on the stony hillsides of the West Bank without irrigation. And thousands of olive trees have been cut down. Palestinian agriculture has always depended on the water of lakes in the West Bank as well as the Jordan River. Again, since 1967, these water sources have been taken into control of Israel, which has drained lakes and rerouted the Jordan River to take water to Israel. With grim irony, the Palestinians are now having to buy back their water from Israel. Emma Goldman identified Zionism as the dream of capitalist Jewry the world over for a Jewish state with all its trimmings, such as government, laws, police, militarism and the rest. In other words, a Jewish state machinery to protect the privileges of the few against the many. The founders of Israel sought to expel as many of the Palestinian people as they could and make their profits by creating an all-Jewish working class. I mean, Israel is the most economically and socially developed capitalist nation-state in the Middle East, with a large proletariat. It is a bourgeois democracy, but also a sectarian state. Israeli capitalism not only exploits the Jewish working class, but also a Palestinian working class living in Israel, which actually comprises about 20% of the population. This Palestinian working class face discrimination and are considered to be second-class citizens because the very definition of a Jewish state excludes them. The OECD reported that 21% of Israelis live in poverty. And the 2005 National Insurance Institute reported that 52% of Palestinians in Israel live below the poverty line, as opposed to 16% of Jewish Israelis. And unemployment averages more than 50% for Palestinians. In 2011, the monthly salary for Palestinian workers was 33% below the average. The Palestinian struggle for their own capitalist state was led for decades by Fatah and the Palestinian Liberation Organization, which are bourgeois, secular, leftist, pan-Arab nationalist organizations. But they basically came to a dead end in the 1990s when Fatah collaborated with the Israeli government. But essentially, Fatah could not meet the economic needs of the Palestinian people. And this led to the success of Hamas in the Gazan elections of 2006. The Palestinian working class are organised in the Palestine General Federations of Trade Unions, which is actually a Fatah organisation that has not had any elections since 1981. So what that led to, the rise of a federation of independent and democratic trade unions and workers' committees, who threatened Fatah with their dominance over the working class. And actually, Fatah actually got the Palestinian security services to actually spy on these new organisations. Let's talk about Hamas. Now, Hamas, again, are also a bourgeois nationalist organisation, an anti-working class. They were established in 1987. They propose an Islamist capitalist Palestinian state to sort of bridge the divide between Palestinian nationalism and Islamism. It's like a twin-track policy of a national liberation struggle and also a jihad, which aims to raise the banner of Allah over every inch of Palestine. And that's from the covenant of the Hamas from 1988. I mean, Hamas are very wealthy because they have rich backers from Saudi Arabia and other Gulf states, such as Qatar. Now, the split in the Palestinian bourgeoisie between Fatah and Hamas, it suits the Israeli state quite well. But in April this year, Israel threatened to withhold tax revenues it collected on behalf of the Palestinian Authority if a reconciliation deal was agreed between Fatah and Hamas. The question is, was the offensive against Gaza an Israeli attempt to sabotage the deal between Hamas and Fatah, to isolate Hamas and punish Fatah? But Fatah entered the conflict by actually firing missiles against Israel from the West Bank. The Secretary General of Fatah's Revolutionary Council said, "We all know that the main Israeli goal has been to break up the national unity reconciliation. We will respond by strengthening our unity and reconciliation." Israel's anger was quite evident when it said the moderate Palestinian leadership has shown its true colours. It sides with the terrorists, not with Israel. In September, after the war, Fatah and Hamas have actually reached an agreement that would turn over the civil administration of Gaza immediately to officials of the Palestinian unity government. For socialists, Zionism and Palestinian nationalism hold back the growth of class consciousness among the working class in Israel and Palestine. But I want to talk about something that quite extraordinary happened in the summer of 2011 during the social justice protests in Israel, which had been inspired by the Arab Spring. Here, Jewish and Palestinian working class people actually united in these social justice protests, and mass rallies shouted mixed Hebrew and Arabic renditions of slogans from Tahrir Square. An Arab writer called Odeh Bisharat addressed a meeting of 300,000 people and announced that the struggle for social justice has always been the struggle for Arab community, for the Arab community. And the people shouted, "Jews and Arabs refuse to be enemies." Emma Goldman identified the origin of the Arab-Israeli war as when the Arab feudal lords had sold the land to the Jews without knowledge of the Arab people. She concluded that the land should belong to those who till the soil. In other words, the Jewish and Palestinian working class, regardless of religion and national identity, in a socialist society of common ownership and democratic control. ISIS. I'm going to call them IS because that's what they're known as now, isn't it? Islamic State. I mean, nobody had heard of ISIS until June this year, and that was when Mosul, the second largest city in Iraq, actually fell to the forces of ISIS or IS. And it was clear evidence that the war in Syria had spread over into Iraq. In Mosul, they took control of the government offices, the airport, the police stations. They took the central bank, holding 500 billion newly printed dinars, which is equivalent to $430 million or 308 million euros. They also got their hands on military equipment such as Black Hawk helicopters, Humvees, thousands of guns and ammunition rounds. It's estimated IS has about $2 billion in its war chest. And they also paraded a captured Scud ballistic missile in the streets of Raqqa. I mean, the rise of the Islamic State is the most radical change in the political geography of the Middle East since the Sykes-Picot Agreement was implemented in the aftermath of the First World War. The Druze leader in Lebanon said to Robert Fisk, who was a correspondent for the Independent newspaper in June, he said, Sykes-Picot is dead. And it's quite true, considering that Islamic State actually bulldozed the border dividing Iraq and Syria. And this is the border based on the 1916 Sykes-Picot demarcation, artificial arbitrary boundaries imposed by French and British capitalism. Islamic State, I've got to make this clear, are not something from like T. Lawrence's Seven Pillars of Wisdom. They're not a Bedouin raiding party that appears dramatically from the desert, wins spectacular victories and then retreats to its strongholds, leaving the status quo little changed. IS are a military force capable of waging war on three fronts. South towards Baghdad, which I believe from what I heard on the news yesterday, they could capture it in the next few weeks. They're also waging war west to Aleppo, and as we know, north and east towards Kurdish territories. I wrote this quite a few weeks ago, so obviously I haven't mentioned Kobani at all, but that is a reference to Kobani, really, north and east towards Kurdish territories. I mean, the military effectiveness of IS has been possible because IS has established a military command of former Iraqi army officers from Saddam Hussein's Ba'athist regime. Field Marshal al-Duri was Saddam Hussein's deputy of the Revolutionary Command Council. And he's been identified as one of the main commanders responsible for the successful takeover of North Iraq and the city of Mosul in June. He's the most high-profile Ba'athist official to successfully evade capture after 2003. He was the king of clubs in the infamous most wanted Iraqi playing cards. After Saddam's execution in 2006, he became leader of the now banned Ba'ath Party. So IS have the support of many Ba'ath Party loyalists, former intelligence officers and soldiers in Saddam's Republican Guard. This explains the battlefield success of IS. It is in effect a hybrid of Sunni insurgent rebels and a Ba'athist organised army. It's a combination of what I think is an internationalist Islamic theocracy and Bonapartist Arab nationalist secularism. Islamic State have taken over the capitalist state structure in occupied Syria and Iraq. They're efficiently running public services, admin and military control systems. They've taken over banks, ministries, law courts, and they're actually operating a taxation system in occupied Syria, which actually taxes the population less than Assad was taxing the people. And the New York Times identified that all this was actually run by a, quote, an effective management structure of mostly middle-aged Iraqis. So IS's control of Syria's and Iraq's oil fields has added wealth to its funds. It exports about 9,000 barrels of oil per day. Some of this goes to Turkish, Kurdish middlemen up towards Turkey. Some goes for domestic consumption. And some goes back to the Assad regime in Syria. IS has also secured revenue by selling electricity back to the Syrian government from captured power plants, only in capitalism. Before IS actually gained access to these oil fields and the banks in Mosul, the wealthy members of ruling families in Saudi Arabia, Qatar and the Persian Gulf provided financial support. And they also benefited from money smuggled via a Turkish border that was left deliberately unchecked. The Sunni Arab working class and peasantry in Iraq and Syria support Islamic State because IS promises them preferential treatment and better economic opportunities than they could ever hope for under the current Shia-dominated leadership in Iraq and Syria. Since 2003, economic deprivation has hit the Sunni Arabs and it has lost its former dominant position in society, and the Sunni have now become the most oppressed section of Iraqi society. The Sunni peasantry has been hit by a series of poor harvests and food shortages in the last 10 years. Severe agricultural decline, neglect and conflict has contributed to a 90% decline in agricultural productivity since the 2003 war. It has to be pointed out that IS is 100 times larger and better organised than the Al-Qaeda of Osama bin Laden. Al-Qaeda never attempted to solve the economic problems of the Muslim working class and relied on international terrorist acts. IS, on the other hand, are securing ground creating a localised state structure and ensuring peasant and working class support through palliatives to the capitalist system, shrouded in a theocratic conservatism. I mean, reforms to capitalism cannot solve the problems facing the working class, regardless of whether the capitalist class wear ties or turbans. The ideology of the capitalist class in the Middle East, opposed to Western capitalism, is now dominated by Islamic fundamentalism. Before, it was a leftist Arab nationalism rooted in state capitalism, such as Nasser's regime in Egypt, the Ba'athist regimes in Syria and Iraq, and the PLO, supported by the Russian state capitalist bloc. Jonathan Powell, who's Blair's former chief of staff, actually, against the current grain of thought, he's actually identified that ISIS is not a small movement of middle-class kids like Baader Meinhof. It's a big political movement like ETA or the IRA, which represents a genuine political strand of grievance. And again, going against the orthodoxy, a backbench Tory MP pointed out that ISIS is a political problem. ISIS in Iraq are Sunni tribesmen who are fed up with the Maliki government. They are international jihadis and they are former Ba'ath regime elements. The only way you're going to get rid of the foreign jihadis is if the Sunni tribes and the Ba'athists do it themselves. If your answer is to start bombing ISIS in Iraq, then what you're actually doing is bombing the tribes and the Ba'athists, who are exactly the people you're going to need to get rid of ISIS. I finished this section on ISIS by quoting Engels. Engels said, all these movements, and he was referring to movements in the Arab world, are clothed in religion, but they have their source in economic causes. So, in conclusion, when the rich wage war, the poor will die. As socialists, we oppose capitalist wars. When capitalists wage war, the working class do the killing and are killed. They're maimed and wounded as soldiers, but more likely to be civilians. Men, women and children. In Gaza this year, 513 children were killed. In fact, 44% of deaths in the Gaza conflict were children, women and elderly men. The capitalist class called this collateral damage. Remember Karl Liebknecht, he said, the main enemy of every people is in their own country. The main enemy is at home, the capitalist class in their own country. War is a symptom and result of capitalism. The only way to fight against war is to fight against the causes of war. Since the causes of war are part of the nature of capitalism, it follows that the only way to fight against war is to fight against capitalism. The only possible struggle against war is the struggle for the socialist revolution. As socialists, we reaffirm that all peoples should seek their emancipation, not as members of nations or religions or ethnic groups, but as human beings, as members of the human race. They should unite to abolish the division of the world into so-called nation-states, and we call upon the workers to organise consciously and politically to use the power at their disposal to bring the bloodshed to a standstill. That's it.
Thank you, Steve, for...
We have a window open.
Well, we'll open it. Oh, about the hot enough. OK, while I do that, if anybody wants to open up discussion, anybody got questions or... You should start for questions. Anybody got any questions you want to find the speakers?
Can I ask a question?
Yeah.
It was probably mainly because you were talking about the late, sorry. Mm-hmm. You were saying about... I'm not sure if you covered this, but in the Ukraine, my understanding is I don't understand... Why are these people forming their own republics? Why are they siding with Russia? Are they generally Russians themselves? Why is this breakup in Ukrainian
sovereignty? Well, Ukraine's a sort of a mixture of like Ukrainian speakers and Russian speakers. That part of Ukraine, the Donetsk area, is in the easternmost part of the country, and therefore... Most nearest to Russia itself, and also has a sizable Russian-speaking minority. And what these pro-Russian separatists? They've been stimulated by the Russian capitalist class to sort of like stir up trouble. And I think Russia really wants to get their hands on that part of the Ukraine.
It's just to feel that. There's a sizable force of them, so it doesn't feel like that Russia's just paying a bunch of guys and say, oh, go against Ukraine. It seems like they must be, are they trying, is there a lot of people feeling that they need to defend themselves against the Ukrainian army, or is it really just people being paid as militia?
Well, I think that's what it is. I mean, also, Russian troops have actually gone in there. I mean, I didn't refer to that in my talk, but Russian troops are actually in that part of eastern Ukraine. And but I would say that the majority of people in the Ukraine seem to want some sort of Ukrainian independence, and a lot of them want to go towards Europe. But at the same time, there's the people in that sort of eastern part who. And also, the type of economy as well. I think in the east, it's the old sort of like coal mines, industrial side. Where like probably in the western side, it's more agricultural. But as I identified when I was doing my research, I identified the miners were actually organising against the separatism in that eastern part, because they identified that they're basically looking at their socio-economic status and seeing that it's under threat either way, whether in Ukrainian independence or even Russian dominance.
Another thing I feel like we always seem to forget about is Crimea. At the start of the year, it seemed a big hot topic that they were voting to join the Russian Federation and leave Ukraine. And now it seems to be not even heard of. And it was supposed to be this kind of undemocratic... One of the worst things that Russia seems to have done in decades, and now it's not even mentioned that Ukraine's even part of Russia now. It's not even mentioned, really.
Yeah. I think it was superseded by the conflict that developed in the eastern Ukraine in April, because the Crimean thing happened at the end of February. But, I mean, as we pointed out, that, like I said, the Crimea has been always part of the Russian Empire, the Tsarist regime, and, like I say, it's the base of the Black Sea Fleet. Yeah. And I think... Then when Khrushchev came to power after the death of Stalin, what they did, the USSR was basically different constituent socialist republics. We're having a conversation.
Sorry, I don't want to stop discussion, but if you want to finish off what you're saying, then.
The Crimea was part of Russia and everything, and it was part of the Ukrainian Constituent Socialist Republic, which has had no technically any independence really in the USSR, and so I mean it's part of. Do you know what I mean? And I think it's just.
They were as much Ukrainian as they were Russian.
Anybody else want to add any questions?
On Ukraine, there was a president, wasn't there, who got out and is in Moscow. It's a friend of Putin, isn't he?
Yes.
Wasn't there an elected pro-Russian president?
Yes.
Was he deposed in
February, because all these Euromaidan protests that started in November, they got more and more bloodier, didn't they, as the months went by. Yeah. And he was backtracked on the deal with the EU. But the people in Kiev and the western part of Ukraine see membership of the EU as something to strive for, and he was basically overthrown. Probably he's in Russia, in Moscow, I've tried not to look at individuals, I've tried to look at it sort of like more broad sweep analysis,
Yes, I was going to ask, are the Russian interests in Crimea purely economic, would you say?
Yes, I mean, there's proven shale gas reserves off the coast, and I say Chevron, which is a Western capitalist company, have invested. They've made a deal of $50 billion deal, which is to actually get in there. And obviously, you can imagine when Russian capitalist guys hear about this, it's sort of like they think they're going to lose a part of the market in the. In the Ukraine, and I would say it's economy. It's also militarily as well, because the Black Sea Fleet is based on the Crimea, and it's the Russian Navy then gets access to the Mediterranean, Suez, to the Indian Ocean. So it's a geopolitical aspect as well as an economic one.
Can I just say, I don't want to try and predict the future in any way, but I feel that, is there any real kind of, does the government really have any kind of idea how this Islamic State solution to how this is going to end? Because if you say there's a lot of support, such as like how there was support for IRA or the ETA in Spain, is it best that we just recognise the state and try and live with these, get on with these people? Because I see these, that there's not much of a correlated difference between how extreme the Saudi Arabia government is compared to the IS government. So are these people always going to have support? Like IS, as you said, they've got support from other nations in the area, even though maybe not directly from the governments, but by wealthy people within these nations. That I just don't see. I feel like, I can't remember the statements, but if you keep pretty much killing, like, the war is going to keep breeding more wars. So we're killing people. If we kill some fathers or some children, all the children are going to do is want to fight and get vengeance for what we're doing over there. And is really military action the best action, if not some sort of like charitable work, actually giving aid in some way?
Okay, yeah. I mean, obviously, I'm a member of the Socialist Party, and we don't support any capitalist wars, and I don't support any intervention in this war. But as a devil's advocate, that's why I quoted Blair's former chief of staff and a backbench Tory MP at the end, because basically these two guys are actually sailing against the orthodoxy at the moment, and they the Americans and the British, you know, just want to bomb everything and think they're going to do that. But they're not. You know, that is going to actually exacerbate the situation. And you've got to, like, identify, I mean, if you're going to be working in capitalism, you've got to identify that ISIS represent a genuine grievance. And, like I said, they've got support of the people because they're offering something to the people that they didn't get anywhere else. And, I mean, if they take Baghdad, I mean, surely they've taken Iraq. I mean, that's the capital of Iraq. I mean, and then they've got quite a sizable proportion of Syria. I mean, I joke with my partner and I say, like, well, surely they should have a seat on the United Nations. You know, I mean, they technically, that's how they're called, the Islamic State, IS. And, I mean, we're calling them, the West is calling them terrorists. I don't see them. It's not Al Qaeda. They're not going around like flying planes into the Twin Towers. They're insurgents, and they've just got genuine grievances, like say the IRA had or the ETA had. So, you know, but obviously I'm not promoting any solution to the problem as a member of the Socialist Party. But that's, I just wanted to quote those two. I think those two guys are really sailing against the orthodoxy.
It just feels like we don't learn from history in any way. We just seem to be deemed to repeat ourselves continuously.
Yeah.
And as you even said, I think it's BBC, I was watching BBC Parliament, I think the day of the vote, and there was many people on TV saying that this is just going to, like, the Gulf War number 3, it's just going to keep replicating itself.
That's what they said, though. They said it's called that. As long as capitalism exists, war will always recur, you know. It's just that, you know, since 1991, it feels like a more dangerous place. The world does feel more dangerous.
Isn't the whole situation in the Middle East, with ISIL, with all of them, the fact that they're all religious, they're all Shia and Sunni, they're all Muslims, and how on earth do you think in terms of, you know, they are working people, a working class, but how do you get the ideas of socialism into, has it ever successfully been done, you know, with religious sects like the Islamists? I mean, it's, God, I mean...
Yeah, but I tried to point out with, like, talking about Hamas as well as ISIL, ISIS, that these are organisations representing the ruling classes in those areas, and they're just cloaking. The religious thing is just a cloak, and it may appeal to certain downtrodden sections of the populace, but essentially as has been going on for 100 years, trying to get local political control and economic control of the region. And whereas after 1945, with the rise of the Soviet Union and state capitalism, a lot of the regimes adopted the state capitalist approach, and that was their way of sort of like trying to create some independent economic area in the Middle East, although Britain and America had their influence over Iran up till 1979. I mean, the 1979 Iranian Revolution is a case in point. I mean, Islam is on the surface, it looks like a religious revolution, but it's not. It's a political and economic revolution to overthrow the Shah, who was basically a puppet of the Western capitalist class, and they're going to run that country themselves, but clothed in a religious mantle. That's what I see.
Before I put to you, does anybody else want to say anything? Point to me.
As this gentleman just mentioned about how they spread socialism in these areas.
Yeah, I do answer that.
Big point. The Kurds, I know they're separated in there's Kurds in Turkey, Syria, and Iraq.
And Iran as well.
And Iran. Oh, yeah, sorry. Yeah. And Iran.
Four countries, yeah.
And I don't know much about the situation. I hope you can enlighten me on it. Mm. But all I've seen that the Kurds of Turkey are a communist, maybe, or anarchist in certain ways. The actual the PKR.
PKK.
Yeah, PKK. And I'd like to know what their situation is. They're like, what type of government they're striving for? Because they're striving for an actual state in Kurdistan, I think, for me. And would they be able to spread like a more left message or an actual socialist, if not going into a communist or anarchist kind of government?
Okay, good question. Yeah, after the 1916 Sykes-Picot Agreement, which was basically a carve-up between the French and the British to carve up the Ottoman Empire, these were an ethnic group, a people that didn't get anything. And like I just said, Kurdish people are living in Turkey, Syria, Iraq and Iran. I mean, Kurdistan might be the name of a country if it's ever formed. So they've never had their own homeland, their own capitalist state. And after the 2003 invasion of Iraq and the fall of Saddam Hussein, the Kurdish people in Iraq have actually got, they've actually self-governed a regional part of Iraq. It's called the Regional Government of Iraq. And I actually was looking on the internet, and they have their own consulate in London, although a consulate is defined as obviously a representative of a proper independent country. But they do have representation in London. Yeah, I mean, the Kurdish ruling class, which obviously are scattered all through these four countries, are trying to establish their own country. And as I said earlier, only in capitalism will you have, like, I know the Kurds are now under attack in Kobani, but previously they were dealing with ISIS, moving oil into Turkey. And again, Turkey's kept its borders open, allowing ISIS back and forth in recent months. But yeah, the Kurds, they're just a people who didn't get their own state in 1918.
Could be a result out of this conflict that the Kurds might actually get their own territory. Because when they're in Iraq, even though they started becoming more autonomous and actually withdrew their representatives from the Baghdad parliament.
Yeah. Oh, yes, something else I can point out to you. The Kurdish regional government of Iraq, since all this recent upheaval, I've actually been shipping out their own oil from oil fields within the Kurdish regional government area, and there's tankers like sitting off the coast of Texas that basically the Baghdad government of Malakai have actually petitioned the American government to quarantine the tankers, because basically the Kurds are actually exporting oil and revenues aren't going back to the Baghdad exchequer, and they're going into the hands of the Kurdish ruling class in the regional area. So there's tankers actually, I think, off the coast of Texas. Whether they've actually unloaded and the revenue has actually come back to Iraq is interesting. But I mean, again, it's the Kurdish ruling class are trying to establish their own homeland and their own capitalist state, like the Zionist ruling class wanted to set up Israel in 1948.
Sorry,
Sykes-Picot,
you said about the English and French.
Mm.
I'm not familiar with that.
Oh, sorry. Sykes was some British diplomat, and Picot, P-I-C-O-T, a French diplomat. The Ottoman Empire was the huge empire that in 1914 would have taken in Iraq, Transjordan, Palestine, Syria, Lebanon, the Saudi Arabian Peninsula, and during the war, the British and the French made an agreement, like, because the Ottoman Empire sided with Germany on the war and therefore was on the opposite side to the Britain and France. So when the war ended, Britain and France would carve up the area. What happened was the British Empire got Iraq, Transjordan and Palestine as mandates, which are semi-colonies, protectorates. Britain obviously maintained influence over Saudi Arabia and the Persian Gulf, and the French got Syria and the Lebanon. And I say, as I was saying to your friend there, the Kurdish people, they didn't get their own homeland, or they didn't even get mandated, they didn't even get taken over as a mandate, you know, they just all split up through these countries. But a lot of people pointed out, I mean, Sykes-Picot, if you think about it, he's actually dead. I mean, the IS have actually bulldozed the border, you know. I mean, in the middle of the desert, it's just a raised bit of sand, and they've just levelled it out. I think that's a fantastic image, you know. It's internationalism, but not internationalism how we want it in the Socialist Party.
Anybody else has not spoken yet?
If you look at the borders of all those countries, they must be out there, all straight line.
Yes. Yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah. I was at my school was invited to a debate or talk at a college or school, and we actually got to speak to a BBC correspondent for religion, and he sort of talks about how that he thought that was the main problem in that area, because those countries' religions have been created and not based on sort of any history, or they just sort of been created, and that kind of divisions between religion and other factors. So
yes, yeah,
and a lot of people see it as a problem which can't really be solved.
Well, in capitalism, probably it would be very difficult to solve it. I mean, in socialism, it would easily solved because there wouldn't be nation states as such. But in capitalism, the only way to sort of solve it would be to redraw the boundaries, I would have said. And like I say, the Kurdish people need to be have their own capitalist state. But like I say, tribes have been split up, you know, like Adam said. Borders have been drawn with a ruler. Mr. Sykes and Mr. Picot, Monsieur Picot, just got a ruler out, and they're just cutting through, I should say, tribal regions or something, and splitting up peoples. Yeah, and so we saw the seeds of this, Britain and France, back in 1916.
Mm-hmm. Actually, Mr. Sykes outwitted Mr. Picot, because originally, those sunny areas, northern Iraq, was going to be part of France, but.
Yeah, it has to be pointed out that in the First World War, I mean, the British war aim, one of the main British war aims was to stop the Germans from getting to the Persian Gulf and to all the oil fields down there. And that was, in effect, Britain then had to get control of those territories with the defeat of the Ottoman Empire.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yes, sorry, I didn't answer that.
It stands for what? It's the Kurdish Workers' Party.
Yes.
It's a Maoist organisation.
Yeah, I was going to say it was some Leninist party, yeah. I mean, they've been fighting. Yeah, they've been fighting. They're obviously just one aspect of the Kurdish resistance. I mean, the people in Kobani are, I think the Kurdish army are the Peshmerga. I mean,
the Iraqis, there's the POK or something.
Yeah.
They're different, but they're again a workers' party, but like a serious side to it.
Yeah. PKK have been around for 30, 40 years in Turkey, and they said there'd be the Leninist, well, as Adam says, the Maoist sort of like type.
I thought I read also they have a lot of small anarchist groups also. Because they've been fighting the Turkish now for, as you said, a long time.
Oh, yeah.
And they've only just been, in the last 10 years, been able to actually speak their own language within Turkey.
Yes.
So they're persecuted quite hard.
Yeah, some reforms have taken place in Turkey to allow them, like their own TV channel, for example. And I was in Istanbul a few years ago, and you get talking to people in bars. Who'd be, I sat stuck behind the bars in Istanbul, and you think you're talking to a Turkish guy. You're actually talking to a Kurd. Because, as English people, we can't differentiate between, say, a Kurdish person and a Turkish person. And the Kurdish gentleman was telling us how, like, the Turkish secular state of Ataturk is based on this unified thing of, like, it's the unity of the Turkish secular state, and you can't have ethnic groups, you can't have religious groups, it's got to be the secular state. And same with the Armenian thing, the Turkish state can't admit culpability about the Armenian genocide because it's like something that the Ataturk regime, which one of the legs of, he described it as a chair. He described the Turkish state as a chair with four legs. And if you start talking about Armenia, start talking about Kurdistan, then the chair's legs start to come away. And the Turkish, that's what, that was the metaphor the Kurdish guy used to me in Istanbul. But
the Armenian thing, that was before Ataturk, wasn't it?
Yes. Oh yeah, but Ataturk was a Turkish officer in the First World War. What I say is that the Turkish state is based on, like, you know, we don't talk about these things, you know. The Armenian thing was 1915, 1916. Ataturk took the power in 1922. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
The president of the Iraq Kurdistan is called Barzani, and his father. Just after the Second World War, Russia invaded part of Persia and set up a satellite state there. And this boy's father was the president of this satellite Kurdish state, which Russia set up. So, I mean, the president was actually born in Russia. But it's a dynastic thing, because you sit on the television and you see the Chief of Defence of Iraq, Kurdistan. He's called Barzani as well, he's a son.
Yeah.
But the thing is, they were a left-wing pro-Russian party at one time, Kurdish People's Party. I mean, they've had a change of it now, but there's no Russia. There's no Russian to support them. They would be sort of, you were talking about left-wing secularist people.
Yeah.
Maybe they succeeded in doing that in that part of Iraq. Mm. I suppose it was better than all the other religious things.
Yeah.